I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to dive into the findings of a soon-to-be-released report from the think tank, the Sagamore Institute. The report is called the Public Good Index, and it tracks the viability and vitality of 11 Indiana cities, including Indianapolis. My guest is an old friend of No Limits, Sagamore Institute Vice President Troy Riggs. Please join the conversation. Call us at 866-476-3881. Email us at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking today about the Sagamore Institute's new Public Good Index. We'll talk about what it is and what it tells us. It's soon to be released. I don't think it's going to be out for at least another couple of weeks, so we're getting an advance peek. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. Well, my guest is an old friend of the program. I think you're not quite at the Saturday Night Live maroon jacket stage.
Not yet, but maybe soon.
Getting there, yeah. It's Troy Riggs, who is former IMPD chief and Indianapolis Public Safety Director and is now vice president of the Sagamore Institute. Welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's always great to be on your show.
It's good to have you here. Let's talk a little bit about what the Public Good Index is first, and then we will dive into the numbers.
Well, the genesis of this actually began a few years ago when Mayor Ballard brought me here to be the public safety director. He asked me to do two things. Number one, and we've had this conversation, the budget for DPS at the time, the way it existed, was 85% of the general fund. It was losing money. And he brought me in to balance the budget. We put all of the budgets in surplus within a year and a half, which was good news. We used sound business practices. But the other part of that was using data to make us more efficient and effective, not just in the budgetary process, but in our operations. So we put some data together and started this long haul of trying to identify issues that were leading to degradation in quality of life, leading to crime. We saw that coming with heroin, some other issues that were developing. And we really put that into action. And because of that, we saw more and more citizens becoming involved. And now Indianapolis stands in a place that the data is starting to help curb the violence. It's starting to bring in millions upon millions of dollars into our community to deal with these issues. And what started with Mayor Ballard and continued with Mayor Hogsett, we need to be clear about that as well, is that in these areas where we focus that money and the attention, crime actually went down dramatically. So we have the footprint, and it all began with data using it. So October of last year, Sagamore Institute came to me and realized that my promise to do at least a year as police chief was coming to an end, and they asked me if I would come to Sagamore, run their business operations, but also look at data not only for our major cities in Indiana, because we're an Indiana think tank, but also look at data for the top 50 cities in the United States. So we want to do Indiana first. It's home. It's important to Jay Hind, our president and CEO, that we've started here. So we'll release that sometime first week or second week of September, and then we'll have the one for the United States in the top 50 cities by the end of the year.
I've gotten a look, an advanced look at the report. Thank you for sharing the information. You look at 11 Indiana communities, compare them. How did you choose? Was it simply by population, those 11?
It was simply by population. We were trying to figure out what are our major cities, and we put a group together and asked. And when we started looking at census data in the first data dive, we realized that between the 11th and 12th city, and I cannot remember what the 12th city was, there's about a 10,000-person population gap. And it seemed to us 70,000 was a good cutoff point as a major city. Talking to individuals on the federal side, they said 70,000 really means you're starting to get to become a big city, and that's really where you need to focus your attention. So as a result, some people said you need to do the top 10. We wanted to do something that was meaningful for what most people would classify as a major city.
And the 11, we probably ought to ought to walk through are Indianapolis, Fort Wayne, Evansville, South Bend, Carmel, Fishers, Bloomington, Hammond, Gary, Lafayette, and Muncie. So pretty much every corner of this, I suppose the Southeast is somewhat underrepresented
right. I mean,
there.
But. The good news, and the good thing for Indiana is that you have some pretty sizable communities scattered throughout the state, which is important for future economic development.
So what were the initial takeaways from looking at this, the things that really leapt out?
You know, before I jump into that, let me just
sure.
say this. The Public Good Index, that phrase was coined by Jay Hine.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason we want to make an index is we don't want to rank cities. People rank these cities, and it used to drive me crazy when I worked for the city, because mm-hmm. they'll take one data point and they'll make that the most important. And they're usually not fair when they rank. What our index does is it gives you what's doing well, what's cautionary, and what's at risk currently.
Mm-hmm.
It's based on information that has developed over decades. So what we say is, please do not use this in a campaign to jab your opponent. This is not an evaluation of current leadership, but it can be used to evaluate leadership from this point on moving forward, because these are the issues they're dealing with. But what really stood out to us as a think tank is that Indiana is doing extremely well fiscally compared to a lot of our competition across the nation. And we were very pleased, and quite frankly, others around the nation are shocked to learn that by midpoint June 30 of 2019, This state could have a $2 billion surplus. That's important, mm-hmm. and that's important because of a lot of reasons. One, you have to have a rainy day fund. Most cities are woefully behind. Most states are woefully behind in providing that safety net for their citizens. But what happens if we have another economic downturn, which is almost certain is going to happen at some point? We have the funding to take care of that. What happens if we have a man-made or natural disaster? That money's there. And then some of the things that we identify is in maybe in crisis in some cities or critical situation, the state, unlike other states, has money to invest in that to make sure that Indiana's third century is its most productive century.
Yeah, and that's one of the points, actually. We had Governor Holcomb on the program a couple of weeks ago, and he made that argument that that's going to be one of the most attractive things about Indiana is that they can say to people who want to locate here that Indiana, unlike most places, will have money to invest. What I saw looking at the report, couple of things, and I should say, echoing, it's not set up, it's not a ranking of cities. Every one of the 11 cities that are profiled here has some good things that are happening, has some that are in that yellow cautionary. It is interesting. The color scheme mirrors that of the traffic lights. So we got the green, yellow, and red.
Well, I've got to remember, 27 years of public safety, it's hard to get away
true.
From it.
The yellow is sort of the cautionary things that are transitional or could go either way. And then every city also has some red, sort of in crisis or things demanding immediate and concentrated attention. What I saw, and we were talking about this before we went on the air, is that even though, as we say, the state's in good fiscal shape, and in most places the jobless rate has dropped considerably, we're seeing something that's disturbing that we've talked about on this program before, is even in times approaching full employment, we're still seeing poverty rates increase in a lot of places.
We are, and I took an old method that we use in city management. I was an assistant city manager in Corpus Christi, Texas, and did a lot with the professionals. And if you're not familiar with the form of city management, there's usually a mayor and a council, but they hire a city manager to run the day-to-day operations. And that was the form of government that I'd worked in before. And one of the things we always looked at was the growth of poverty between set years in comparison to the growth of population. Because really, if you think about it, if you're growing population, it's important to know what your poverty growth is or reduction, because that growth in population, that taxpayer dollars that's coming in, is going to be eaten up a little bit by poverty. And if you look at the state of Indiana, four of our 11 major cities lost population, but all of them saw an increase in the percentage of people living in poverty. And during that time frame between 2000 and 2015, we had almost 240,000 new residents living in major cities throughout Indiana, even with those four cities that lost population. The problem with that is that poverty in our major cities grew by 164,000 people. So that's a pretty enormous amount of people. Mm-hmm. That's well in excess of 50% of your growth could be attributed to poverty in some way if you look at it in a city management form. That means that fewer than half of your people in population growth have to support the others, and that's not sustainable long term. It's even worse in our cities like Indianapolis. Our major city, our economic engine, in 15 years grew by 89,000 individuals. Poverty grew by 85,000. That's only 4,000 net increase, people working, paying taxes in our city. That's why our city's struggling at times. That's why nonprofits are struggling with services as well.
Well, and we see also that the median income for Indianapolis dropped during the period from 2010 to 2015.
You did read this, didn't you?
I did. Yeah. No, I always do the prep before I come on the air.
I've been here for a while. Just having some fun. Yeah, and that is surprising. As a matter of fact, out of our top four cities in Indiana, three of them actually saw median income decrease. Which, what does that mean to the average citizen? The average citizen in Indianapolis in 2000 had a dollar to spend. Now, that same dollar in 2015 is worth 70 cents. That's how far we've fallen behind the inflation rate nationally. And when we're looking at some of the national cities and some of our competitors, they're doing much better in median income than we are.
We are talking with an old friend of the program, Troy Riggs, now with the Sagamore Institute, about the Sagamore Institute's soon-to-be-released Public Good Index, which takes a look at the vitality, viability of 11 Indiana cities. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. Track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Or you can do what our regular listener Jerry has done and send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Jerry writes, I have a rather deeply personal question for today's guest, and I will not be offended if he simply declines to answer. How does a relatively progressive thinker survive and succeed in a political and social environment dominated by reactionaries?
It's difficult. And that's why at Sagamore we believe in citizen-led government. We believe that the very foundation of this republic is that. And quite frankly, I think that's how you overcome reactionary type efforts, is you understand what the needs are as being a good citizen. You stay the course no matter what the situation is in front of you. When we start reacting to things, sometimes a quick reaction is needed, but sometimes it results in overspending, going way too far down the road. And I'll give you an example of this that will try to be as non-political as possible. Think of 9/11. I still remember that. My generation, anyone that was living then remembers that day. That there was a lot of reaction that occurred after 9/11. We now know that some of the laws that were put in place were too strict and had been struck down by government. But we also know that because of that reaction to that event, that wasn't well thought out, there wasn't a plan beforehand for an attack, that this country spent literally millions, maybe billions of dollars that it didn't have to. That's not wise government. That's reactionary government. That's why we have to be good citizens. We have to understand the situation we're facing, and we also have to hold elected officials accountable. Things can't be fixed overnight. They can't be changed overnight. We didn't build a great republic overnight. It's going to take some work and effort, and it's very difficult when you're facing a crisis to stay on the plan and in the course of action when you have so many people raising red flags and special interests. So being a good citizen, being actively involved in elections, being actively involved in civic discourse and conversation is the way you overcome that.
Well, and what I see, you and I have talked several times now over the years. I think I've talked with you in every capacity you've been in here and since you came to the city. And the word you almost always use is punctuation, is data, facts. Is that tough in an environment, I'm refining Jerry's question here a little bit, that thinks at some level ideology trumps inquiry?
It is, but you just have to continue to be there on the platform and the debate of ideas and philosophies. We have to be involved in that, and quite frankly, we have abdicated a lot of that to government leaders. Leaders have an important role, but they're not necessarily the ones that are supposed to dictate the course of government. That's up to the citizens, and that's why we have to have those long debates and conversations about the issues that affect us today, and that's difficult. It's difficult to stay that course, especially when you're dealing with a crisis.
We are talking with the Sagamore Institute's Troy Riggs about the soon-to-be-released study, the Public Good Index. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking with Troy Riggs, formerly Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department Chief and Indianapolis Public Safety Director, now Vice President of the Sagamore Institute, about the Sagamore Institute's soon-to-be-released Public Good Index. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Ron has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Ron, welcome to the program.
Hi, John.
Hi. What's on your mind?
Well, here I go once again. I'm a small farmer, and something that I've considered over the years to improve the situation in the cities, in the state, in this country, is to connect the dots as to how we got to this point. We got to this point because the ADMs and the Monsantos, with the assistance of the government, kicked small farmers off the farm so that they could control large acreage. And at this point in time, and for years now, the government even pays these farmers not to plant crops. And I assume that can be traced back to the stock market and prices. And if you consider, at one time, say you had a 10 farmers farming 100 acres. Well, those 10 farmers needed a tractor. They needed a car. They supported families. They supported the local schools. And then all of a sudden, you have one farmer farming 1,000 acres. He only needs one tractor, one truck. And that's what happened to industry. And so in the process, if these small farmers get kicked off, can no longer make a living off their small farm, they move to the cities. And then what happened? Then NAFTA came in. And when NAFTA came in, the jobs left the country. So now you've got a bunch of people that are losing their families, losing their houses, losing their cars because the jobs have left. Then what happens? Now they turn to opioids. It can all be connected. And I just heard recently on the news that one of the upper states, I believe it is Maine, is trying to reverse the process just for that reason, to break up the large farms, give them back to the small individuals. Thanks, John.
Thanks very much for the call, Ron. Take care. Well, that's actually kind of an articulation of classic Jeffersonian philosophy there, that the small farmer is the receptacle of civic virtue.
Well, and that's basically, we began as
an agrarian society.
As agrarian society, and yeah, it's always going to be an important part. You know, being a farmer, smaller, it's very difficult. I've got a friend of mine that retired from the police department, and he always farmed while I was there, and I've always been impressed by the way he is able to handle business and how business works and watching commodities. But he brings up some interesting points. A lot of those points are debatable by a lot of different individuals, but what I think, if you get to the crux of that, is what you really see is you have in economic vitality. If economic vitality is lost, poverty can slip in. When poverty slips in, people start getting hopeless. When they get hopeless, you start seeing mental health issues. You start seeing opioid abuse. You see a lot of those issues. So sometimes we don't think that a farmer losing his job or a UAW worker at Ford Motor Company losing their job has the effect of a rising crime rate, but it can. when you put all that together. Not everybody that loses a job is going to become hopeless, live in poverty, have a mental health issue, but there's a greater likelihood that will occur. All these things work together, and that's what we're trying to demonstrate with the Public Good Index.
Well, and that's what the thing that I think is intriguing about it is that the implied argument is that there's no simple cause and effect, that you can't just trace one thing to the next. It is more like the spider, to use the spider web analogy, that you touch one point in the web and the whole thing vibrates, and you don't know exactly where the impact is going to be felt.
Well, and there's another thing that's going on that I have to give credit to Mayor Scott Fadness of Fishers. We've been talking about this, and I really wanted his thoughts and suggestions, and he brought up something I thought was very profound. We're known for agriculture, we're known for transportation, and we're known for logistics. Now, the caller was just talking about agriculture, but let's think about that along with transportation and logistics. Those are things that drive the economic engine of Indiana. It's one of the reasons we have a $2 billion surplus. But one of the risks in the future is that those are three of the industries that are going to be highly automized after some time. Mm-hmm. So automation is going to step in. I mentioned my friend that was a small farmer. He used to hire 15 to 20 people. Now he has a handful because of automation. That's going to remove more and more jobs that we have traditionally relied on here in Indiana. How are we going to overcome that in the future?
We probably ought to, before we go too much further, talk about, the criteria for determining public. What things did you look at? We talked about the places, but what were the standards for determining what was in the public good?
Well, we went a little bit deeper in Indiana because it's our home state. But basically, on all the cities that we'll look at, we will look at median income. We will look at their charitable giving because that's important to deal with some of these issues. We'll look at debt, fiscal stability, education levels, poverty levels. Those are really the basics that we look at.
And violent crime,
violent crime as well. And not only violent crime, but police personnel. How many police personnel they have? That's sworn and civilian, because it takes more than sworn. Cities make a terrible mistake of hiring more officers, but they don't have enough support in civilian, so you're really inefficient when you do that. We want to grow the Public Good Index over time. We think that there will be some corporate sponsors that will step up to help us do this down the road, and some nonprofits. But when we do that, we want to start not just looking at the fiscal stability. We want to start looking at bond debt. Are people starting to bond for the right reasons, for road infrastructure needs, or are they bonding their debt? And that's where a lot of cities are now hiding their economic issues, is they're bonding debt. And we know of some cities, quite frankly, that are bonding police cars and fire apparatus for way more years than those vehicles will actually be in existence. That's something that has to be addressed. We're hoping that the Public Good Index can address it over time.
What were the surprises that came out? I mean, I'll say, just looking at it myself, and admittedly, it's the smallest city on the list that you've got. I was a little surprised to see how well Muncie came, because it's not, and I'm not saying this to disparage Muncie in any fashion, but it's not often a city that works its way into the conversation about Indianapolis cities or thriving communities. But a lot of the, it had a lot of stuff in the green or the yellow green, and including some surprising, like it leads the state in charitable giving, things like that. How did what surprises popped out for you?
Well, for Muncie, just civic involvement, the numbers there are very high compared to other Indiana cities and national cities. Their charitable giving, like you said, is the highest in Indiana, which means that some of the issues they're facing in red, they're already starting to deal with some of those, and that's why that's in green. You know, housing is very low cost there, so it's a place that people may want to move to start a family and business. Transportation costs, but a lot of the innovation that you see is community-driven, and that's something that really impressed us in Muncie. I guess when you talk about surprising to us, we've talked about some of the data on the drop in median income. That came as a surprise. The poverty rates, I knew they were going to be bad, especially for Indianapolis.
Didn't expect them to be
I
that
had
bad.
No idea that if you compared growth of poverty to the growth of population, be 95% of our population growth in Indianapolis. But then seeing how large that growth was in the state, that was a surprise. But the thing that really concerns me is when you compare us as individual cities to national averages of education for major cities. All of our competitors, those cities around us, we do not fare very well with them when it comes to college graduates in any of our cities, with the exception of Bloomington, which has a university, so it skews their data, and Carmel and Fishers. Really, if you excluded Bloomington because of university, Carmel and Fishers are the only two cities in our entire state that outpace our regional competitors in bachelor degrees.
And speaking of that, you know, like in Muncie, are there factors with each of these cities that sort of skew the numbers? I'm thinking probably, you know, since the Ball Brothers Foundation is very active in that area and has a focus on Muncie and is dedicated, that could drive up the charitable giving numbers considerably.
It could, but, you know, we're looking at the charitable giving, so we haven't broken it down to what comes from a foundation, what comes from people, and that would be hard to do as well, because sometimes in these foundations, it's the residents in that community given to the foundation as a result. What we want to look at is how much funding is actually going in per capita. And so that includes all of that, which means that maybe you have one or two that's giving most of the money away, but that's a city that has one or two giving a lot of money away that other cities don't have. So it still shows that there's a lot of civic pride and civic involvement.
So it's the focus is more on the impact rather than the origin.
More on the impact. I mean, as we grow PGI, that may be something that we would look at. But quite frankly, there may be some things that would be more important for decision makers to understand than that. That's one of those things we'll have to reevaluate come 2018-19. And then hopefully with the next census in 2020, there'll be a brand new set of data that can be examined.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about the soon-to-be-released Public Good Index from the Sagamore Institute, talking with Troy Riggs, who's now vice president of the Sagamore Institute, about the findings. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, track us down on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Rob has done and reach out to us via Facebook. You can find us there at No Limits WFYI. Rob writes, do you think there is any correlation with a poverty rate increase due to the aging population? And aging is A-G-I-N-G. I wanted to make sure I didn't slur that.
I don't have the data yet, but I am almost certain from what I'm seeing out in the streets and going to some of the different things and talking to people in the services, we're seeing more and more people that are aging that are having issues. Specifically, I'm speaking of here in Indianapolis. I'm on the board of Gleaners, the food bank. We had a meeting this morning, by the way, and looked at some of the numbers. But one of the things they did when I was director of public safety is they took the data, they started doing these care mobiles in individual areas, and they have fed, they provide food. They don't provide a meal, like a hot meal. They provide food that you can go home and prepare for your family. So you show up once a week during the summer, they give enough food for your family for the week. They've provided 100,000 people 600,000 plus meals in just 2 years, and that doesn't include this year. We originally thought that the need would go down. The need continues to increase, and I noticed in the budget today that they're forecasting more of a need, and they're going to need more money to make that happen. When you go and stand in line to watch the individuals there, or you volunteer, and they need volunteers, if you go there and you volunteer or you stand there and watch, you're going to see more and more people that are elderly. You're going to see volunteers that when they're finished, they get right back in line. These are individuals that are 50, 60, 70 years of age that had a job, lost it in the great economic recession, and now they're having to balance their funding of housing needs to medical needs to food needs. It is really a rising issue, and it's something we have to be very concerned about as we move forward, especially over the next decade or two.
Gotten an email from a listener named Sean, and again, our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. Sean writes, there is an easy way to raise that average and even save the taxpayers money. Give people with disabilities work. Disabled Hoosiers feel like racehorses whose gates won't open. Study after study shows that people with disabilities work harder for less. There's a whole demographic just wasting away, just dreaming about working. And then he adds a P.S., small farmers are great American heroes.
Well, he's right on both accounts, American heroes, and many of the individuals that have a disability can be very productive. And I worked for a lady named Rebecca Jackson, who was a county judge executive in Jefferson County, the county that Louisville sits in. And before she became judge executive, before she got in politics, she ran a nonprofit because she was a school teacher that worked with people with special needs, and she was really upset that they would graduate high school to the couch at home. So she got a job placement service involved. She placed people on jobs, and she took me and opened my eyes up, as the email and the individual, the listener, had sent in, where everyone working there had special needs. And talking to the business owner, they were the most productive workers he had ever had. His revenues increased. He was able to give them raises. And it was the happiest group he's ever had in the world, highest morale. And he had expanded that all because someone said, these individuals need a chance. They drove that company to profits, and he continues to reach out to help those. So that's near and dear to my heart. If I see an institution or a business that's utilizing some of the special needs, I quite frankly will frequent it more. They're valuable employees, and they can't be overlooked.
What are the hidden opportunities? I want to follow on the spirit of that question. Hidden opportunities that these findings reveal.
Well,
for the state.
The first thing that I will say is that we are talking to you. We've talked about this a little bit, and we're already getting great interest, which shows what's remarkable about Indiana is Hoosiers care about one another. They are galvanized by the data. They want to get involved. You're seeing that here in Indianapolis. You're seeing it make a big difference here in Indianapolis. I think it's going to make a big difference in the state. I'm hoping that other cities will adopt it as well. But this state has a lot going for it. That budget surplus is tremendous. The leadership on the state level to get us to that surplus, realizing that that's investment dollars for the future, is going to be important in utilizing that to make sure that we address some of these issues. The nonprofits that are really focusing now using data, and more importantly than the nonprofits are the individual givers that are now just not giving dollars to a cause, but they're wanting to see a true social return on investment. And something I'm very excited about that we're doing at Sagamore is a Sagamore Renewal Fund, where you have individuals that are investing in getting people jobs to get them off poverty in the inner cities throughout Indiana. That is using capitalism to uplift people and to bring them back to an area that they can feel good about their production, they can provide for their families, and they can be a productive part of this community.
What were the parts of the findings that caused you the most alarm, the trends that came out of looking at this?
The amount of poverty we do not have in this study, but also the amount of young people being raised without two parents. Mm-hmm. If you look at any study, those children start, if everybody else is at the starting line, they're 30 or 40 yards behind. Mm-hmm. That's something that I think we have to have a civil, social discussion about and how we handle that moving forward. But the other one was the amount of people suffering from some form of mental illness, whether it's anxiety, severe depression, it's a clinically diagnosed disease, or if it's because of the condition they find themselves, that seems to be one of the leading health concerns in every major city in Indiana. Actually, it's the number one health concern in every city of Indiana, except for Indianapolis, where it's number two.
Are there any outliers, any cities that sort of escape that? Or is it all across the board?
Fishers and Carmel.
By and large.
Prosperous. And, you know, money does solve a lot of issues, but not all the issues. Mm-hmm. And they have some problems just because of the tremendous growth. And they also have problems, and this is where people are surprised, but they also have problems with depression. And they're really focused on suicide prevention because they're seeing an increase in that. So just because there's wealth and mm-hmm. there's high education doesn't mean that people are doing well mentally.
We are going to continue our conversation about the Sagamore Institute's Public Good Index, which is going to be released in just a couple of weeks. My guest is Troy Riggs of the Sagamore Institute. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Be Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking with Troy Riggs, now of the Sagamore Institute, where he's vice president, formerly IMPD chief and Indianapolis public safety director, about the Sagamore Institute's soon-to-be-released Public Good Index, which takes a look at the vitality and viability of 11 Indiana cities. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Kenny has done and send us an email at nolimitswfyi.org. Kenny writes, Mr. Riggs' description of the impoverished as draining resources and the taxpayers must support them belies a fundamentally profound misunderstanding of the public good. It is not leftist to acknowledge the well-researched and widely agreed economic fact that free enterprise always creates a residual class of unemployed. In the case of Indiana failing, by all national comparisons, to invest in childhood education and ignoring continuing adult re-education, then economic probabilities of working poor and unemployable poor are assured. It is not clear what new insights or value this gentleman brings to the critically urgent issue of wealth distribution in Indiana or nationally. The shortcoming of his understandings and his biases are clearly on display. Troy, I'll give you a chance to respond there.
Well, I don't know what bias is. I'm just giving data. And if the bias is I believe in citizen government and economic forces rising all boats, I do believe in that. That is a philosophy that I believe in. But I believe what this email showcases is exactly what we hope to accomplish with the PGI. Get people talking about the issues that matter. He obviously concerned about poverty, has reasons he thinks poverty is the way it is. Let's have that conversation, because what I have learned in 27 years, now 28 years in public service, is that none of us has all the answers. And usually the truth is in between those on the left and those on the right. It's somewhere in between where most of us live, and we have to be willing to sit down and have that conversation. And one of the conversations we need to have is how does the current growth for some people making dollars and growing their median income, how come it's going so well for some but not for others? We have to address that, and we have to have a set-down, reasonable conversation without name-calling. We have too much name-calling as it is right now, too many people pointing fingers. What we're hoping to do at the Public Good Index is what can we do to increase the public good so that everybody has those basic fundamental rights that all citizens have, right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It sounds simple, but it's extremely hard to do.
Let me take Kenny's question, though, I think, or the point is that we don't do enough to invest in education, particularly early childhood, to intervene in some of these folks who are not perhaps on the right path, or the folks who get caught by a fundamental shift in economic forces and find that they were trained for an industry or an endeavor that, you know, that market changes have made obsolete.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Do we do enough to help those people, A, either build their lives and careers, or B, rebuild them after some change that perhaps they had no control over?
I have seen some areas in some states that, yes, they have done enough, and they've done very good weathering storms. But quite frankly, a lot of other states haven't, and we need to be aware of that, and we need to be focused on it. That's why we have to have an active group of citizens talking about these issues. If you look at, for instance, the state of Kentucky years ago was known for tobacco, burley tobacco. Mm-hmm. The state, and Mitch McConnell was a new senator at the time, was on Capitol Hill looking for investment dollars to help train people into new jobs, and that worked very well. North Carolina did the same thing with the a tech triangle that it has, and mm-hmm. really invested in it, helped. There were some people left behind, and they had to support them. But I will say this. It's not just government's responsibility. We have tremendous nonprofits. That's something that's uniquely American that can help as well, and that's what we're hoping this data will achieve long-term, is to get more of those individuals involved. But I will say this. We can have a conversation about early childhood education, and I'm a big believer in that. I want everyone to have those same opportunities. But, John, here's the issue we also have to talk about. How is that going to benefit a young person that goes home to an empty house? And when I mean an empty house, a single mom raising them, they're having to work, and the child's there by themselves. They're struggling to have food, proper nourishment in the home. There's a lot of issues that go along with just giving them early education. We also have to be concerned about their safety, their health, their food sources, and just their health care in general. Those are all issues. We just can't put someone in the classroom earlier than we do now and think that that's going to solve our issues. It's not. It's going to take a lot of other really thoughtful people figuring out how to get all these services to wrap around.
We are talking with the Sagamore Institute's Troy Riggs about the soon-to-be-released Sagamore Institute's Public Good Index, which studies the vitality, viability of 11 Indiana cities. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimitswfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what Melissa has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Melissa, you're on the air.
Hi, good afternoon, John.
Certainly.
I was just wondering, Mr. Riggs sounds awfully like he's preparing to run for political office. I'm wondering when he's going to run, because he seems to be, you know, has a lot of handle on the data and can talk all day about it. I'm not hearing a lot of specifics from him, you know, but I'm just wondering when he's running for office.
Okay. Well, thanks very much for the call.
And what he's running for.
Thanks.
Let
for
us know.
Thanks very much.
Make the announcement.
Thanks.
And I appreciate it, Melissa. I am not running for anything. I'm committed to working to try to improve my city as a citizen and as in the state as well. But I will tell you, I can talk about details on every one of these on things that I think could be done to fix poverty, things that I think could be accomplished to improve education, things that I think we need to do now to ensure, as I said earlier, that Indiana's third century is its best and most productive. However, that's not what the goal of the Public Good Index is. The goal of the Public Good Index is to give you, the citizen, and those listening this information so that you can form your own opinions and challenge your own government and nonprofit and faith-based organizations to really utilize citizen-led government to lead us to the answers. Not one person has the answers to all these issues, but I know one thing about the American experiment is that the answers are within the society where we live. And that's why we have to be actively involved. So I would love, I work at Sagamore, if you ever want to grab a cup of coffee and get my views on these, I will do that. But that's not my role today. My role is to say, here's the information. Let's work on that as a group of citizens concerned about the well-being of our fellow Hoosiers.
We have a Facebook message from a listener named Martha. And again, you can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. Martha writes, 10-acre farms, seriously? Government has not kicked farmers off the land. Mechanization moved people off the land starting in the 1920s, and that escalated post-World War II. Never did little 10 or even 100-acre farms have tractors in the good old days. Small farms today that have machinery and employees are raising high-value crops such as orchard or dairy. Grain farms are large because the gross income earned per acre is small in relation to expenses. Livestock farms can get by on less acreage because what they raise grain-wise is fed to animals. Your sentimental caller is ignorant of basic economics.
Well, and once again, we've stirred up a debate.
Yeah.
The one thing that I would caution people is what we say with the Public Good Index. Let's have these discussions without the name-calling. I mean, I think we need to have these firm discussions about the future of our city, the future of that. We know the agriculture is going to continue to be automated. That's not necessarily a bad thing. It's a good thing for production. It's a good thing for lowering cost of food. It's a bad thing for those individuals that are losing their jobs. How do we deal with that? Logistics here in the state of Indiana. We have a lot of individuals that are employed through trucking services. But what happens is that becomes more automated. I saw a report the other day said 15 years trucks will be fully automated going across the nation. Is that too soon or not? I don't know. But the fact is they're going to be automated. What are we going to do for those individuals that lose their jobs in that field? How are we going to be prepared for that? And we really have to have a plan.
Well, I guess then that gets back. We talked about the early childhood education, but the other point of Kenny's email question was the continuing re-education for adults. I mean, if that's the case, you're right. There are going to be a lot of truckers who are thrown out of work. That historically has provided a pretty good living for some people that's no longer going to be available. How do we retrain them or make it so that they are not left out in the cold?
Well, one of the suggestions I would have is that one of the things that the federal government has traditionally done very well is that it has done forecasting on what the U.S. government and or what the U.S. economy is going to look like in a few years. And I remember when we were changing from manufacturing to service industry, and they were talking about that 10 or 15 years. A state or a city that's serious about this, looking at that forecasting, listening to those individuals that have studied this and understand the trending, and looking down the road, and what are those jobs that are going to be needed in 5 years? What are those jobs going to be needed in 10 years, 15 years? Start training for that now so that we can have that economic stability. That's doable. And what's so good about the public good index is that we know these, like these three that we talked about, be fully automated at one time or close to full automation, is that we've got time to use some of that $2 billion and invest in things to ensure that this next generation has good job potentials. The American economy will adapt. It has to. It's a world economy now. We have to ensure that we have workers to fill that workforce.
We've gotten, on this point, we've gotten an email from a listener named Reg. And again, our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. Reg writes, in all this yammering and hand-wringing about the unfortunate fact of GOP dominance in Indiana politics, my local left-wing newspaper and other news outlets have neglected to cite a recent study ranking Indiana numero uno when it comes to state governments. Gosh, those Republican meanies are succeeding while states long dominated by Dems are collapsing under the weight of their own self-induced fiscal insolvency. Yet this fact seems to go unreported much of the time.
Haven't broken down the data on individual cities as far as who's got a Democrat, who has a Republican. I'll allow that to the political pundits. I will say this, that I do believe, and this is a personal belief, that you're far better off in your personal finances and as a city and a state if you spend less money than you take in. That's important. We all learn that in our economic classes, and we have far too much of the reverse going on in government. A little bit of money for investment is good. Too much money burdens future generations. And when you look at the United States deficit, it's going to burden future generations. You look at a city like Chicago, one of our great American cities, out of 116 cities, over 250,000, there's 116 of those in the United States of America. Chicago ranks 116th in fiscal stability. It gets a score that I didn't think was possible of an F-. Those are issues we have to talk about regardless if it's a Democrat or Republican in charge. That is not sustainable, and that could have a crippling effect not just on Illinois, but can also substantially hurt the United States of America because it is one of our major cities.
That's one end of the spectrum, and I guess part of my job here is to play devil's advocate. And we've talked about the $2 billion surplus that the state has amassed, and obviously that public officials like to boast about. But while that $2 billion was being collected, we've seen a lot of things, poverty rate increasing and a lot of other indicators that suggest that we have some real trouble in the foundation of the state. Isn't there at some place a happy median? That $2 billion, by and large, sits in the bank. It's not moving those numbers right now. Is there an argument that we can have too much of a surplus, that some of these funds should be reinvested in trying to deal with these problems right now?
That's certainly something that should be discussed, and that's one of the reasons we put it as a green in the public good index as a positive, that we have this money, but we also want to alert people to, hey, we've got a $2 billion budget surplus on June 30th, 2019. What do we do with that? Is it good to have that large of a deficit? That's a conversation point. And we'll hear some people that says we need to spend it immediately. Other people say over time. Some will say leave it in the bank, just use the interest that accrues. That's going to be up to our legislative body and our governor and the leadership there. They've made good decisions to get us to this point. But if citizens are concerned about lack of services in areas, then they need to go to the state house and lobby. They need to go to local meetings and talk to leadership. They need to be involved in their government. That's what moves government, because it is supposed to be citizen-driven.
Gotten a comment from a listener via Facebook. Again, you can find us on Facebook at No Limits, WFYI. This is from a listener named Sierra. Sierra writes, I think it is interesting that when you speak about the importance of early childhood education, you feel the need to shift the attention to other issues like single parenthood and hunger. Early childhood education has value in its own right and deserves to be addressed as a distinct issue.
I agree that it does need to be addressed. I'll disagree that it has to be a distinct issue. I disagree that we talk about crime just as a distinct issue. I disagree that we talk about a budget surplus as a distinct issue, because nothing's that easy in government. I've worked in government for 28 years. I understand what you're saying, and applaud the passion she has for that, but I've seen far too many young people go to a local church to be cared for because mom's off working because she has to and she's struggling. But they're getting help, they're getting assistance, but they still lag behind other kids because when they're sitting in that class, they're hungry. And we know by studies that even if you have education early age, if you're hungry, that's all you're focused on. And we have far too many young people doing that. So I want children to have an early education. I want us to invest in that. But while we invest in that, let's not forget there's more to that human being than just giving them that opportunity. For them to succeed, they need to make sure that they have the proper health care and they also have the proper nourishment, or they're not going to succeed with early health care. Then that money we've invested has been lost.
And we're getting close on time here, but it strikes me that perhaps some of the disconnect here I can cut through is that Sierra is saying early childhood education has value even for those children who have two-parent homes, and all of that has its own good. What I hear you saying to some degree is those kids, by and large, are not going to be the ones who are in crisis, and that we need to focus on this as for the kids who are in crisis at some level. Fair assessment?
I think it's a very fair assessment, because there's a lot of individuals in our community have an opportunity to provide for their children. I've been blessed to be able to do that. But I grew up in an area where we didn't all have that opportunity. And I think it's our fundamental responsibility as American citizens to ensure that every young person has those same fundamental rights that we enjoy as American citizens.
That will have to be the last word. I'd like to thank my guest, Troy Riggs of the Sagamore Institute. Hope you'll come back. I think there's going to be another iteration of this in December before the end of the year where we look across the nation. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.